off with Nietzsche, died 1900. Now we got to back the clock up and show that this Enlightenment rationalism, the kind of effect that it had on Christian thought. So basically we've been following the trend of the leading thinkers of Western civilization, who went from being, you know, you had Christians were the leading thinkers, then all of a sudden deists were the leading thinkers. Then next thing you know, the leading thinkers were atheists. Well, how did the Enlightenment rationalism influence the church? Well, it was influenced in what is called, you know, in biblical studies, what is called higher criticism. And so we go back to the early to mid 18th century. So you go back to about 1750, and you know you had lower criticism. Lower criticism, it forms the foundation. Okay, so it'd be like this is lower criticism, and then you build upon that foundation with higher criticism. Lower criticism is that there's nothing wrong with that. What you're doing is you're trying to restore or regain the original text on the basis of imperfect copies. So a lower criticism is textual criticism. Okay, you're just looking at all these different copies of the New Testament. You're trying to find, well, what did the original Gospel of John actually say? Higher criticism, on the other hand, it starts to look for the authorship, the date, and the integrity of each book. In other words, higher criticism assumes the possibility that the traditional authors of the scriptures didn't really write it. It assumes the possibility that the book might lack integrity, and somebody who said he was the Apostle Paul really might not have been, and that the early church may have been grossly mistaken by all of this, and it may have been written at a much later age. Okay, and so men do not die for what they know to be a hoax. So as leading thinkers of Western civilization, including biblical scholars, Old Testament and New Testament scholars, as they began to get more guys influenced by the Enlightenment rationalism, and they began to reject the belief in miracles, they had to explain away the Old and the New Testaments. And it was much easier. You know, no one was going to believe just calling the apostles and the prophets liars, because these are guys who were willing to die for their faith. So what they had to do was say, well, maybe these were legends then. Maybe these really weren't written by the apostles and the prophets. Maybe it was legends written hundreds of years later. And so that was the type of thinking that was done. So higher criticism came into existence. Also, eventually you had form criticism later on, which sought to find the supposed oral traditions that lie behind the written documents. It's extremely subjective. You try to say, well, we know these things were written much later. You know, as time went on, that gap got smaller and smaller. Now we acknowledge that Paul's writings were less than 20 years after Jesus' crucifixion. And so they're trying to say, well, were there any, maybe there were oral teachings that got stretched and became legendary in just 20 years. Well, legends actually take several centuries to wipe out core historical data. You don't have that long of time. And it's really interesting, but through form criticism, we actually did find some oral traditions, some ancient creeds and hymns, which predate the writing of the New Testament. They go back to the early 30s AD. The problem for form critics is that it teaches the same things that we find in our Bible today. By the way, the notes that I'm teaching from, I'll try to get a copy to you next week, but before I get into Friedrich Schleiermacher, I want to just cover a little bit about the Old Testament studies and how that was changed. But the big transformation in Old Testament studies due to the Enlightenment rationalism comes under the heading of the documentary hypothesis. The theory that the Pentateuch, the law of Moses, the first five books of the Bible, Genesis through Deuteronomy, the theory that the Pentateuch was a compilation of different written documents composed by different authors at different places and different times long after Moses. Okay? If you're going to reject the Bible and you're going to reject miracles, then you're not going to say, well, Moses was a liar. you're going to have to say, no, this was written later on. It's legendary stuff. The common liberal bias was either atheistic evolution or at least deism. Either way, either you have no God or a God that doesn't perform miracles. But basically, the common liberal bias is anti-supernaturalism. Miracles are impossible. Therefore, we have to reject the Bible as it is and try to find out what really was said. So revelation from God, prophecy from God, miracles are impossible. And then they join that with the evolutionary school of origin of religion, the idea that animism, believing all nature is animated with spirits, evolved into polytheism, belief in many gods, which eventually evolved into monotheism, belief in one God. And so this was combined to attack the scriptures. So I'm just going to throw out a few names here. Jean Ostruck, in 1753, he argued that different divine names, these guys were looking for anything. They would accept anything as evidence to throw out the Mosaic authorship of the first five books of the Bible. So he said if different divine names are used, that points to different sources. He started going through the first five books looking for the Elohim source, the Elohim, the name for God, versus the Jehovah or Yahweh name for God. That was in 1753. So you see this very early on in the history of the Enlightenment, guys are already starting to attack the scriptures. And this isn't much different than what Benedict Spinoza was already doing. However, he came at it more from a philosophical standpoint. These guys were biblical scholars, and now they were starting to attack the scripture. Wilhelm M.L. DeWitt said Deuteronomy was written at the start of Josiah's Reformation to unify worship of the Jews in 621 B.C., because it talked about someday building a temple and common law for the Jews, the second giving of the law, Deuteronomy. Now, he said that in 1806. And now, it's interesting because if Moses wrote Deuteronomy, you're going back to about 1450 B.C., he said, no, it was written in 621 B.C. at the start of Josiah's reform. So, in other words, Moses never wrote this stuff, and Josiah just says, this stuff is still, you can still touch it, and the ink's still wet, the ink's not even dry. And he tells the Jewish people, oh, this was written by Moses. We have copies from Moses. And it starts reform, and they want to do all the animal sacrifices that are listed in there. To me, that's if anything's anti-Semitic, that's anti-Semitic. I mean, it acts like the Jews were fools. Well, no, the Jews were intelligent people. Somebody's not going to write a book. I mean, even as bogus as Dan Brown's Da Vinci Code is, at least the documents he's talking about, the writings, the Gnostic writings, go back to about 140. Some of the early ones go from 140 to 280 AD. Yet it's bogus because it doesn't go far enough. This would be like Dan Brown taking a document written, you know, a week ago and fooling us. Now, I have to admit, was it the dossier papers were actually put together in somewhere in the latter half of the 20th century, a forgery, and some people were duped into believing that it's, or some people still believe it's an ancient document when it's been proven to be fraudulent. But whatever the case, this liberal bias based on Enlightenment rationalism led to the documentary hypothesis. So you have Ostruck with Elohim and Jehovah, different names for God, must be different books. We now know that the nations that surrounded the Jews in the Middle East and the Near East often had more than one name for their primary deity. So, I mean, there's no basis for this. DeWitt's arguing basically that Deuteronomy was too advanced for a legal code to date back to 1450 BC. But now we have the Hittite legal code, which is just as complex, if not more complex, than the Mosaic Law. Hermann Hupfeld divided the Elohim document into E1 and E2. One part later became known as the Priestly Code, so the Elohim passages that dealt with sacrifices and all became the Priestly Code. E1 and E2 ended up turning into E and P. the letters, and then Jehovah was J. Then Abraham Kuhner gave the GEDP order in 1869. So it's about 10 years after Darwin's Origin of Species. Now you have the Jehovah passages were written first, Elohim passages written second, Deuteronomy third, the priestly code fourth, and then Julius Wellhausen supported the GEDP order with the evolutionary view of religion, that animism evolved into polytheism, which evolved into monolatry, which evolved into monotheism. That was in 1878. So the final conclusion was that the Jehovah portion was written somewhere about 850 BC, the Elohim portion written in 750 BC, Deuteronomy 621 BC, and the priestly code 570 to 530 BC. Now, this is all based on the assumption that miracles are impossible. Now, we don't really have time to offer a thorough refutation of it. In my apologetics, intro to apologetics course and advanced apologetics course, you can get a full lecture on the refutation of this, because I have literally pages of evidence. Well, maybe I can give you a little bit of an overview, but whatever the case, as refutation of documentary hypothesis, the 20th century scholarship repudiates this view, but rather than turning back to Moses, they turn to more and more liberal speculation, okay? It involves circular reasoning. They assume revelation is impossible to then prove that the Bible is a human book. Revelation is impossible. It's impossible for God to write a book. Therefore, the Bible is not a book. They're assuming exactly what they're supposed to prove. They explain away opposing evidence with a hypothetical editor. Elohim portions and the Jehovah portions are often part of the same verse, the same sentence. Two different authors. So it's like, well, an editor got together and pulled all this stuff together. And that's why you see all this similarity running through the first five books. And they teach that only the Hebrews couldn't use more than one name for God, when we now know the ancient Babylonians, the Ugarit, the Egyptians, the Greeks, and even the Muslims. I don't recall what the other names for Allah were, but there was more than one name for the primary deities of each of those places. They assume secular history is always right when it differs with the biblical account. You could have a historical book with dozens of proven errors. If it differs with the Bible on some factor, they just assume, okay, well, then the Bible must be wrong. They assume the Hebrew religion evolved into monotheism, yet Israel was the only ancient nation to have a true monotheistic faith. So it's like, this is the exception. This is not the rule. Regardless of what's going on with other nations, now we know that it's the other way around, that primitive religion started monotheistic and devolved into polytheistic faiths. They take passages out of context to prove the Bible has contradictions. No solution is accepted. They reject evidence for much Semitic repetition in literature by the same author. So in Genesis 1, you have God creating the heavens and the earth in six days, resting on the seventh day. Then in Genesis 2, it's another giving of the creation account, but the focus is on the creation of Adam and Eve and the Garden of Eden. Okay? Well, that kind of repetition is common throughout Hebrew literature. And they just reject that and say, no, these are two different accounts that were merged together, despite all the evidence for Semitic repetition. And they assume that they can scientifically reconstruct the text more than 3,000 years later and do a better job than what the ancient Jews believed, who were much closer to the fact. There's so many evidences for the Mosaic authorship of the Pentateuch. The unity of the first five books, if they deny the unity, then why'd they come up with the hypothetical editor? Okay? But that implies a single author. In the New Testament, Jesus calls Moses the author. The Pentateuch itself calls Moses the author. The Old Testament calls Moses the author. You have eyewitness details in the Pentateuch. The author is acquainted with Egypt, but he's unfamiliar with Canaan. It's like he's never been there. He's talking about a place he's never been to. Moses fits that to a T. There's a desert atmosphere and point of view, a nomadic lifestyle. there are second millennium BC customs time and time again with the sale of land and things of that sort, and the covenants that are made go back to the second millennium BC. How would somebody writing 5 centuries BC have known that? There's a greater percentage of Egyptian words in the first 5 books than the rest of the Bible combined. It's as if the author was trained in the Egyptian language. Moses' qualifications, according to Acts 7:22, his education, his knowledge of Egypt and the area of Sinai, all qualify him for the author. The different names, different divine names, are used for different contexts. When God has spoken of his Elohim, it talks of his creation work and his power. When he's called Jehovah, it speaks of him in covenant relationship with his people. The variation in diction and style, you have different types of literature. Moses is going to write a little bit differently when he's dealing with genealogies than he is when he deals with biographies or other historical accounts. Okay. Also, good authors vary the text to prevent monotony. He's not trying to bore the death out of us. Okay. And parallel accounts were a poetic style very common to Semitic peoples, including the Jews. Even a study of ancient religions, as I stated, show that primitive peoples had technical sacrificial language and started with an original monotheism, which devolved into animism and polytheism. There used to be an argument that no one wrote as early as Moses' time. We now know that writing existed long before Moses' time. Now, Moses' time, the Rosh Shamra literature of 1500 B.C., but we also have receipts of business deals in writing found in Egypt that go back to 3000 B.C. So just common business people could write 3000 B.C. What reason do we have for rejecting Moses' writing in 1450 B.C.? Much archaeological finds confirm the Pentateuch, the city of Ur, Shechem, and Bethel, the Hittite legal code, the use of camels. You realize that at one time, these scholars coming right out of the Enlightenment argued that there were no such thing as the Hittites. They never existed. Then we dug a little further and they had apologists. Okay, the Hittites existed, but they were not this advanced civilization that the Bible talks about during the time of Abraham, about 2000 B.C. Well, now we have the Hittite legal code. We have their suzerainty treaty, the latter half of the second millennium between a king and his people. We now know that they were a very advanced culture for their time, and nobody doubts the biblical account at this point. So it's kind of like they use instances like that to doubt the credibility of the Bible. So that's the foundation for their doubt, they claim, not their biases. Then that foundation gets removed, and we find the Bible is right after all. And so they build this whole house of cards on no foundation. The foundation is gone. Ancient legends of creation and worldwide flood are found throughout the world. They're possible perversions of the true biblical account. Because, yeah, I mean, in the Gilgamesh epic and the Babylonian account, you have one in the flood account. The ark is shaped like a Coke bottle. It's not going to, it's going to turn round and round, and it's going to just... an animal is going to kill everybody on board. It's not believable. The biblical account is believable. It has the exact proportions that you need for a large barge, which is designed that the more you weigh it down, the harder it is to capsize it. And then it's the largest ship built until like the 1880s. And there's 3 floors that more than enough for all the species of animals, the original species of animals from which our animals came today. And all you had to do is with the real big animals, just get them while they're smaller. But whatever the case, the Genesis flood by Henry Morris goes a long way to explain that. Finally, with the Jews accepting the law as Mosaic during Josiah's reform in 621 B.C., it's hard to believe that any large portion of it had just been written. I don't think we should believe that the Jews were that naive. Now, this type of thinking was carried on throughout the rest of the Old Testament, like Joshua and the conquest of the Promised Land, that was questioned. But now through the Amarna tablets, written between 1400 and 1350 B.C., we have reports from the kings in the land of Canaan, the area of the land of Canaan, reports from them to Egypt requesting assistance from the Haparu invaders. Now, and a lot of those reports coincide perfectly with the book of Joshua. Some of the reports do not. What we need to understand is Haparu was probably an ancient variation of the word Hebrew, coming from Eber, meaning those from across the river, from across the Euphrates River where Abraham originally came. And you had many of these invaders, not all Hebrews, keep in mind, were Jews. Okay? So some of the accounts are going to lock on perfectly, but there's also, we know, we have knowledge of other invaders who may have been descendants of Eber as well. Isaiah, they went to Deutero-Isaiah, they split Isaiah into two so that they would try to keep away from fulfilled prophecy. You can't do it. Isaiah 53, it's so detailed, the predictions of Jesus the Messiah, and Isaiah had to be written at least 200 years before Jesus walked the earth, because that's when the Greek translation of the Hebrew Old Testament took place, the Septuagint. So detailed that growing up Roman Catholic on Good Friday, I thought that it was an eyewitness account of Jesus' death on the cross, and I didn't find out till after I became a believer at age 21 that it was written in the Old Testament by Isaiah 700 years before Jesus walked the earth. You know, even Pat Robertson, the 700 Club, they sent a reporter on the streets of Jerusalem, and he would read Isaiah 53 to people and ask, who is this about? And they would stop and they'd say, that's easy, that's Jesus. And then he'd say, you realize this is one of your prophets, a Jewish prophet, Isaiah, writing in the Old Testament 700 years before Jesus walked the earth? And then they'd get all ticked off at this guy and say, well, then I guess it's not Jesus, and they'd storm away. That's how clear the prophecies are. There's no way to explain them away. The book of Daniel, they try to do the same thing with it as well. So whatever the case, the Enlightenment rationalism had such a big influence on the leading thinkers of Western civilization that it infected biblical studies in the West. A lot of these, by the way, like Wellhausen, a lot of these guys, the W's are pronounced like V's. It tells you where these guys are from. A lot of these guys are coming out of Germany. German thinkers were the first ones to attack the scriptures and destroy the faith of the people in the scriptures and destroy the faith of future pastors. So in other words, in all of Europe, the first country to apostatize, where the church leadership apostatized, was Germany. And, you know, Germany leads the way, for better or for worse, in philosophical and theological and religious thought. Well, they were the first church to apostatize, was the German church. And what filled that vacuum? Emerging of Nazi occultism and the German Volk religion, the German national paganistic religion. It was what filled the vacuum, the void of Christianity. Remember, Christianity, ancient Christianity, replaced, dethroned paganism. And in Nazi Germany, the vacuum that was left was not filled by atheism. If it was filled by atheism, it sure didn't last that long, because then there was a return, a resurgence, a revival of ancient pagan beliefs in the merging with the political thought of the Nazis, an occultic belief system. And, I mean, the Nazis were so New Age, they were looking for the lost continent of Atlantis, they were looking for the Holy Grail, the list goes on and on. Hitler was in contact with spirit entities, and the Thule Society is just was the German branch of the Helena Blavatsky's Theosophical Society. So, whatever the case, what happened in Nazi Germany, that's where Europe and America are heading. We're heading in that same direction, and that's why the New Age movement is on the rise. I really recommend Richard Terrell's book. I don't even know if it's in print anymore. It was out of print for a while, but Resurrecting the Third Reich, where he talks about the Third Reich is being resurrected on a global scale now through the New Age movement. And that's scary because you can't turn to the Allies. This isn't you know, a national thing that spreads throughout Europe. This is a global thing. This is Nazism on a global scale. That's what the New Age movement is all about. Though most New Agers look like nice people, well, I would almost guarantee that most Nazis seem like nice people too. As long as you came close to the master race, or as long as they weren't the executioners themselves. But whatever the case, in New Testament thought, it was influenced more and theology. The influence began, he became known as the father of modern theology, Friedrich Schleiermacher. He lived from 1768 to 1834. Now, he was trying to protect Christianity from Enlightenment rationalism, though because of Enlightenment rationalism, he did tell his father, I cannot say that I believe this stuff any longer. I don't believe in the resurrection and the Trinity and things like that. His father told him, I still love you, but I got to disown you. Yet his father did keep in touch and did continue to help support him and things like that throughout the years. But he was trying to protect Christianity from Enlightenment rationalism. Now listen to me closely on this. He agreed with Immanuel Kant, okay, that Christianity does not belong in the category of pure reason. You can't prove God's existence through pure reason, through reason alone, okay? The Christian faith is not a rational thing, okay? But then he disagreed with Kant, because then Kant said, however, you could prove Christianity to be true, a watered-down version, Kant's watered-down version of Christianity, you could prove it to be true in that through practical reason. In other words, our moral experience, we need to posit the existence of God, a personal God, a future of judgment and rewards. Otherwise, we can't make sense of our moral experience. Well, what he was saying was Kant is right. Christianity doesn't even belong in the category of reason. But he's wrong to say, therefore, Christianity is nothing but morality. Okay? It deals only with what is right and what is wrong, man's duty. Instead, Schleiermacher saw three categories. Reason, action, which deals with behavior and ethics, and feeling. And Immanuel Kant just ignored feeling. And so Schleiermacher, as the father of modern theology, basically the father theological liberalism, he argued that religious experience belongs in the category of feeling, that religion is more than mere ethics. That when you get right down to it, ethics are its own category, and that maybe it flows from religion, but religion itself is a feeling, okay? That religion involves self-consciousness, consciousness of the self, and our feeling of absolute dependence. That we have this feeling that it's almost like we have this feeling like we've stepped off a cliff and we're not falling. We're standing on air and we're thinking, wow, what holds us up? And he's saying that's what religion is. We don't know what keeps us in existence. How do we get in existence in the first place? We are absolutely dependent upon something. Oh, this must be God. Okay? Now, there's some element of truth in that. But when he tries to make that everything that religion is, and he takes it out of the realm of reason, he's going way too far. You see, these guys, and I will say this, presuppositionalist apologists, defenders of the Christian faith, who use the presuppositional methodology, they like to brag about how they're so true to the Bible and this and that. The Cornelius Van Til and the late Greg Bonson and their followers and Gordon Clark and his followers. Fact of the matter is, those boys backed down from Enlightenment rationalism. I don't care what pastors in Seattle are saying. I don't care what Christian leaders throughout America are saying. They backed down. They put their tail between their legs and they backed down from Enlightenment rationalism. Instead of standing up and saying, no, our God-given reason shows us strong evidence that God exists. Maybe we shouldn't be too arrogant when we present our evidence. Maybe we should humbly present our evidence. But for the life of me, I don't know where backing down from rationalists and then acting like we're supposed to presuppose the truth of Christianity instead of defending it. No, they're backing down just in a different way. I'm just glad the presuppositionalists hold to all the essentials of the Christian faith, but the fact of the matter is they're still backing down from Enlightenment rationalism. Even now there's these postmodern Christians. Talk about, boy, I don't want to sound mean, but talk about being theological wimps. Where now all of a sudden it's like Chuck Colson is in dialogue with some young postmodern Christian where the guy doesn't want to admit that we Christians have the truth. We just, our community has a narrative that we gather around, but none of us can say that we really have the objective truth. Well then, who cares about Christianity? But we've got to stop backing down to the world and stop being so impressed by the world. That's what caused liberalism. That's what caused neo-orthodoxy. Though neo-orthodoxy was just as much a response against liberalism as anything else. But whatever the case, we just need to get back to God's Word and have some confidence in God's Word and in God, the evidences that God's given us in His through nature, natural revelation. He said religion is outside, Schleiermacher said religion is outside the realm of reason. Doctrines like the doctrine of the Trinity and the second coming of Christ, they're not essential Christian doctrines. The only thing essential to Christianity, according to Schleiermacher, is the consciousness of salvation in Christ. Yet look at the kind of Savior that He gives us. Jesus is not literally God. He is not God by nature. According to Schleiermacher, He's merely a human who had the supreme awareness of His dependence on God. So everybody is religious. Everybody has this feeling of dependence. But Jesus had the absolute feeling of dependence. He had the highest level of this experience of dependence on God. So dependent on God that He was dependent on God for everything He said and everything He did. So we could talk about Him as being God, but He really wasn't God. He just experienced God to a greater degree than any of us. Jesus, in the end, Jesus is divine because He's more perfectly human than we are. So that's how far liberalism ran from Enlightenment rationalists who argued that reason that was disproving the Bible. I think Pascal's response is much better. Pascal says, look, reason is a powerful tool, but men use it in a dishonest manner. And if they're biased against the Bible, they're going to use their reason against the Bible. And see, I don't even fault the presuppositionalists saying that everybody has presuppositions. Why not presuppose the truth of the Bible? Fine. But then we can still look for evidences to see if our presuppositions are true or not. If we can do that, we've left the presuppositional camp. Okay? We're using evidences for the Christian faith. So that's Friedrich Schleiermacher, who became known as the father of modern theology. Now, next week what I want to do is, so now we've got this watered down Jesus. Now what I want to do is kind of trace some of the key thinkers in the quest for the historical Jesus. You see, once you assume, and I'm doing a work on this, hope to get it published in the not too distant future, but once you assume the presuppositions of the search for the historical Jesus, once you assume miracles are impossible, then automatically the Jesus of the Bible is not the Jesus of history. So if you want to find the Jesus of history, you got to say, well, since the Bible reports miracles, we're going to consider it false until proven true. We're going to accept the latest dates possible. Those are all liberal presuppositions. And if miracles are possible, every one of those presuppositions is a weak presupposition. Once we acknowledge the possibility of miracles, the whole historical search, the quest for the historical Jesus, for the most part, becomes a waste of time. And I do think that there's something to it, that we could find evidences that the Jesus of the Bible is the Jesus of history. But if we're going to rule that out to begin with, we will accept no evidence for the Jesus of the Bible. And then what is the different quest for the historical Jesus produced? You always created Jesus in your own image. So if it's a Marxist searching for the historical Jesus, he finds a Marxist Jesus. If it's an existentialist searching for the historical Jesus, he finds an existential Jesus. Okay? And everybody creates a Jesus in their own image. In the end, you put Jesus back in his Jewish historical context, and you end up finding out that the Jesus, true Jesus of history, is one and the same with the true Jesus of the Bible. So we'll do that next week. We'll talk about the quest for the historical Jesus. Keep in mind, Schleiermacher is trying to rescue Christianity, kind of like Kierkegaard after him, trying to rescue Christianity from the attacks of the rationalist. But now we're going to start seeing some guys saying, no, we can find a Jesus through deism and rationalism. So you're going to see the pendulum swing back and forth. We'll talk about the first quest for the historical Jesus this next week.